Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's our Healthy Lifestyles program this morning, and our focus this hour is finding relief from pain. Anyone who's experienced acute or chronic pain knows it can impact all aspects of life. Pain can cause irritability and depression, prevent us from getting exercise, proper sleep, and even eating a healthy diet. Today, we discuss an integrated approach to identify and treat the root cause of the pain, plus provide pain relief. With us is Dr. Daniel Sheehan, staff physiatrist at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital on the Cape. Welcome, Dr. Sheehan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Explain what a physiatrist is.
Yeah, it's not a term that I typically use because it does get confused. So it can be pronounced physiatrist, which sounds a lot like psychiatrist or podiatrist. So I generally say rehabilitation medicine, and people seem to understand what that means, unless they think of rehab as like drug or alcohol rehab. But we're talking about rehabilitation from, say, physical injuries like orthopedic injuries. But other doctors in my specialty, that's what I do, is mostly a term that I'll coin is orthodegenerative diseases, like arthritis and degenerative disc disease. But other doctors who are rehab medicine doctors will also treat spinal cord injuries or brain injuries like concussions, but also neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. So it's a broad field, which almost has a little bit of an identity crisis, if you will, insofar as it's hard to define because it's very broad and trying to rehabilitate function and prove people back to a healthier lifestyle.
Now, we think of Spalding as a rehabilitation hospital for people recovering from surgery or injury, but you see a much broader spectrum of patients. What are the typical reasons patients are coming to see you?
Correct. So I joined Spalding Rehabilitation Network, which is part of the Mass General Brigham system, and it is probably in the nation, definitely maybe in the world, one of the best rehab networks. But in addition to the inpatient side, we also do outpatients, meaning which is mostly probably number one and number two diagnoses that we see would be low back pain and neck pain. So we rehabilitate conditions more than just the very dramatic cases.
Yeah. Now, when we're in pain, our priority is to get relief as fast as possible. But does understanding why we're experiencing pain have to go hand in hand? And if so, what are some of the ways that you root out the cause of pain?
Exactly. And it sounds almost uncaring or callous, but I would say that I look at when a patient has pain as an opportunity. This is an opportunity to find out what is wrong with your health. And, rather than saying, what can I do right away? I got to get rid of this. I got to cover it up. But maybe it's a chance to dig deeper and, like you said, look at diagnostics. So that is where it starts, is with a very, very thorough diagnostic workup in neck and back pain and joint pain. MRIs are critical, having, blood tests. But even as we look at these, so an original imaging may be primarily to rule out cancer, rule out infection, maybe a fracture. But beyond that, say, what if the person still has pain, even though they say there's not much to see on the MRI or it looks like just wear and tear changes? That's still very, very significant. So as an example of that, when I look at an MRI, I also look at people's back muscles, which I would say it's been described in literature as correlating with outcomes and how quickly someone can rehabilitate. And if we can address that and say this is an opportunity to see an area of future improvement, which will not only help them get better faster, but remain better. And like we said before, to get back into a healthy, active lifestyle, which we know will circle back to prevent future injuries.
Yeah, you mentioned that back and neck pain are probably the most common pain complaints that you see. And both of those can be caused by so many different things, right? I mean, it's not always easy to determine right away what's causing that pain.
Correct. And we look for, on the one hand, and I'm speaking very generally, but on the one hand, there are common themes, which is, like everybody's heard about core strengthening and say, but what are the reasons why the muscles are not weak, are not strong enough to hold the spine stable, and then there could be micro instability. Now, not every patient has the same situation, but that is a common theme that we could address for most patients, speak generally like for the purpose of this interview, and say, well, mitochondrial function would be a key part of keeping core muscles strong, not just doing a specific exercise. We have excellent therapists in our system, and they focus on teaching exercises, looking for muscle imbalances, my side from the medical point of view is to look at conditions that could be contributing to that muscle weakness or proximal muscles, or these muscles that work constantly, the ones that have to hold up your neck and your low back.
Yeah, it's really amazing that, you know, I do want to mention the core strength for a second, because that's an issue I had for years. I just thought I had some kind of a weak back or something, you know, and, right. and just, you know, go to the chiropractor and, you know, and but yet it still kind of flares up every now and then. And then when I joined the gym and was doing a lot of core exercise, it completely went away. So it just goes to show that, you know, you really have sometimes a lot more control over your pain than you might think. I mean, for years I didn't think, you know, I thought, oh, this is just what it is. And it turns out I just needed more core strength.
Exactly. Which touches on a great point, which is the idea of empowerment, the idea that you can be in control of this. It's not just fate that you're going to wear out and you have to deal with a life of pain. The tables shift toward something that you can actually do for yourself. And that's important belief, that we can heal, so we're not like car parts that wear out. Like if you're, you know, you have bad tires on your car and you see a mechanic, you're not going to just drive on it until it feels better, you know, until the tread grows back on your tires. You're going to have to fix those tires, but that's a very kind of passive way of being treated. We want to make patients active participants in their care. And they have to be involved, and the body will respond to that and will actually promote healing.
Yeah. Now, talk about experiencing pain in one part of your body, but the cause of the pain is actually coming from an entirely different area of the body.
Sure. In our world, it could be someone that has pain. Say they come in and they have pain radiating into their leg or into their glute muscles, and they think that there's something wrong in their piriformis muscle or their sacroiliac joint. But it actually is very, very likely that it's upstream from that area. An example in a different specialty would be someone having a heart attack, and they have shoulder pain, and they have pain up to their jaw, but there's nothing wrong with their jaw. There's nothing wrong with their shoulder. They need their heart to be checked out. So that's why the thorough diagnostics of looking beyond the one area that hurts and looking at other areas. And those analogies work with other areas too, as far as when someone has back pain, they'll often say, well, I did something wrong. And I use, the same analogy of a heart attack. If someone climbs a flight of stairs and they start to have chest pain, it's not because climbing stairs is bad for your heart. It's because they, for the months and years prior to that, had an unhealthy lifestyle as far as their exercise pattern, their eating patterns, and maybe monitoring their blood work and their metabolism. But the same cofactor, same risk factors are true for back problems. And if someone lifted a heavy box, it's probably not lifting the heavy box. It was a problem they weren't training that, and they had maybe other health problems that were under the surface that didn't surface at that point.
As we age, we often experience pain more frequently or in more places, and some people might think pain is part and parcel of aging. When should we pay closer attention to our pain, and what are the potential consequences of ignoring pain?
Right. I think we always should pay attention to it. I think it's our natural way of our bodies trying to tell our brain that there's something wrong. I would even go so far as if you see your healthcare provider and they seem to dismiss your pain or tell you that it's just because you're getting old and, you know, what should you expect? You know, that kind of this is the way it is. I would not accept that answer. I would leave with the mindset of a fight and say, well, you're going to fight this and you're going to find out what it is. These are the kinds of patients that I love to see, that they demand more and they want more answers, not just the superficial answer that this is the new normal, to say, I got to figure out what's actually causing this and be willing to do the testing and do the treatments. And actually maybe number one is do the research. Is if you read more about it, there is information about aging. There's great research being done throughout the country that it's not just, the overstated line, age is not just a number. We all have seen an 80-year-old person who is super active and very healthy. And we've seen people much younger who are seemingly very sick and not very active and not seemingly their age. But I think if we get informed would be number one, but two would be connecting with physicians who understand this and would check. And then the patients on that I see are often very adventurous. They're willing to try innovative treatments rather than just accept that this is the pain is normal.
Back in 1984, the MacArthur Foundation released a landmark 10-year study revealing that 70% of physical aging and approximately 50% of mental aging is determined by the lifestyle choices that we make every day. What does the current science tell us about how we age and the rate at which aging happens in with our lifestyle choices?
Well, and absolutely. Lifestyle would be the number one variable that we can control today, and I think the research is finding out why those numbers appear, meaning are there chemicals that are changing in our bodies when we exercise, and how can we maximize that? Could it be that it's producing healthy chemicals or removing waste materials that are otherwise degradatory? So we're learning more and more how to maximize that, and even the healthy lifestyle is also healthy eating and food and sunlight, for example. Vitamin D has been correlated multiple times with aging effects, both physically and cognitively. So I think that we're learning what are the mechanisms of this, and sometimes we do need supplements or medications to augment the exercise. You know, we learn it from, you know, the performance-enhancing sports world, but also the aging research is excellent. There's and books written, like David Sinclair is at Harvard, and there's the Buck Institute in California. They're doing excellent research on why we see these effects.
What I was thinking of, you know, sometimes you hear, somebody say, oh, it's an old football injury, or, you know, it's some injury that you've had in your younger years, maybe not as a teenager, maybe your 20s or 30s, you know, you had some ski accident or something, and this recurring pain that happens. Should we keep in mind about, you know, injuries in our younger years? Are these injuries that can plague us later? And is there anything we can do to reduce that?
Right. I call that the origin story, you know, kind of like the people tell themselves this story and say, well, I have this because, and then there's an overworn story that we tell ourselves that is our reason why we can't particularly exercise or why we have that trick knee. The overwhelming evidence is that the exercise is good for our health and so many more benefits than detriments. So I don't think that if someone was an athlete when they were in their teens that they're going to, quote-unquote, pay for that later in life. In fact, there have been studies that show that even if an avid exerciser has more arthritic changes on x-ray, they tend to have less pain associated with that and definitely less disability associated with, say, x-ray changes of arthritis in a knee. It does not correlate to overall decreased health. So I don't think that exercise is bad for people. And if we tell ourselves a story that I've been dealt this card of genetics or I had this injury in the past, we all have injuries, and it's part of normal life. If you look at a young child falls and they get up and they don't damage themselves for life, it's part of normal activities. You're going to have injuries and you should heal from them. And the body remodels itself. Different parts at different ages, but bones every 10 years, muscles every 5 years. So they're completely remodeled constantly.
So let me ask you the opposite. On somebody who has, say, been an athlete or maybe a dancer, or what about muscle memory? No, short term, like, you know, if you don't work out for, say, a year and you go back, your muscle memory comes back pretty quickly. Does that happen long term? I mean, how long can you count on that muscle memory bouncing back?
Yeah. Well, it's a neuromuscular pathway is the from the brain to the peripheral nerves to the muscles have this training that they do that they kind of, once the pathway is established, almost like a marble in a groove, it starts to kind of repave itself back out. Now, it depends on the activity. Now, some very skill-oriented activities may be harder to gain back, say, like archery, or even exercises that are more explosive exercises, like lifting a weight. If you lifting, bench pressing 200 pounds, you're going to lose that pretty quickly, and it will take a while to gain it back. But other activities, such as walking for 5 miles, if someone is up to walking a longer distance, they will not lose that as quickly, and they will always remember that to get it back more quickly than someone who never, ever does an endurance activity.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. Daniel Sheehan from Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's our Healthy Lifestyles program, and we are focusing on finding relief from pain, talking about an integrated approach to identify and treat the root cause of pain, plus provide pain relief. And with us is Dr. Daniel Sheehan from Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital on the Cape. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Talk about the differences between chronological and biological age.
Yes, we were mentioning that a little bit. And I guess we've all seen a patient, or a person, I should say, who is out in the community who is 80 or 90 years old, and they are spry and healthy and active and playing tennis, playing golf, just have a quick, hop in their step. And that would be an example of someone who maybe have a chronologic age of 80, 90 years old, but they're acting as if they're 50 or 60 years old there, biologically. Now, there are tests that we can now do to kind of modify. People are trying to kind of determine how can we figure this out. So there's a concept called a Horvath clock. Dr. Steve Horvath came up with this idea that there are changes in the DNA, and we can actually measure this. They used it for forensics, but they can use it now. The hope is that we can use it to test whether or not medical interventions or lifestyle interventions are truly making a difference, and making a difference in whether or not someone is biologically as old or young as their kind of birth date would tell you.
So does it make a difference what type of exercise you're doing? We often talk about, just walking is good for you, but does it have to be walking, swimming? Is it something aerobic? What type of exercise are we talking about that's most beneficial?
Right. Well, number one is that it has to be something sustainable. So if it's something that it doesn't hit a personal interest, so I usually answer that question with a question, and I ask a patient, what do they like to do? What is your idea of exercise? Like, what are you actually going to do? If I'm talking to a guy who's a former football player who is 300 pounds and tell him that, yoga is going to be the exercise for him, he may not feel comfortable doing that. And similarly, some other patients don't want to do weightlifting. But there are studies that show that intensity matters. For example, there have been studies about interval training seems to have some changes. I actually think that in one study like that in particular, they compared it to what they called endurance training, but the endurance training was incredibly low intensity. So endurance training has to have either a distance to it or a time that's significant to also have intensity. So I think that's the theme. If you're going to exercise, do something you like and do it with some intensity. I think they're both very helpful, meaning both being resistance weight training and endurance exercises are both really important. But it could be something social, like golf and tennis are a good component of exercise as well.
Or pickleball. Pickleball has gotten, I have not tried it myself, but there people are really into that. That's sort of a new trend. Pickleball or curling, most people can do. There are things that could also be fun that doesn't seem like exercising, right?
Exactly. You don't have to be, it doesn't have to be arduous something you dislike. It ideally, if it's fun, I think you're more likely to go back the next day and do it again. I think that it depends on a person. Now, some people like to exercise alone, and some people do like to be mm-hmm. with others. I think that makes more difference, and consistency. So if it's something that we do, many of the studies look at what's the minimum amount of exercise we could do. But I don't think that should be 100% the question. It should be, what do you actually want to do every day, mm-hmm. say, 6 or 7 days a week, then that's probably the right idea of what to exercise. Not looking at the minimum of, say, you know, I turn it around. If someone says the minimum is, you know, 3 days a week of 20 minutes, well, that means that anything less is a heart attack waiting to happen, or is just absolute poor health. It's so, like, well, we're not trying to find the minimum. We're trying to find what you like to do and will actually sustain.
There was a woman in my gym in her 70s who was in great shape. And she said, you know, growing up, her parents have said, you have to do something, some kind of exercise. So whether it's walking or, you know, biking or so something every day. So she did different things every day. But she, again, was in great shape. And I thought, boy, those parents really taught her a good lesson, didn't they?
Yes, exactly. Lifelong lesson.
Yeah. Ryan writes, I recently started going to the gym doing cardio and weightlifting. I enjoy going every day, but wondering if taking rest days is a good idea to possibly prevent injury. I don't currently have any injuries and would like to keep it that way.
Right. Then if you're not, like we said before, pain is the signal that maybe it's too much. But variety is important. So variety of, even if it was the same weightlifting, you would change the exercises of the weightlifting. And if he's doing some cardio or endurance exercise and weightlifting, even then the cardio could be different. It could be a bike, could be a treadmill. Even on the treadmill, you can have much variety of doing a steep incline, doing, you know, fast and slow intervals, or just doing a long, slow workout. So there's variety even within cardio, and there's variety definitely within weightlifting. But I wouldn't recommend doing the same exercise every single day. That's probably do need rest and recovery. And then this speaks back into the medical side. That's what we try to do, is say, what can we use to help people recover faster? As we get older, we tend to recover more slowly, and the question is why. So if someone was enjoying their current exercise routine and not having injuries, I would not tell him he needs to get rest because there might be fear of an injury. But if he was getting injuries, I'd say, well, do we need more variety, or do we need to look at what changed in his health, like hormone levels?
Let's talk to Heather, who's giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Heather.
Hi there, Mindy.
Hello.
Good. It's nice to hear Dr. Sheehan, and welcome to our community.
Well, thanks. I go to Orleans, and I'm in Sandwich. So.
Wonderful. I wanted to hear you touch on the effects of Lyme and Lyme disease in our area. Both my son and myself have had Lyme several times in the time we've lived here, and it really does affect both your physical pain in your physical joints and your body with headaches and other symptoms, but it also affects your mind.
Right.
And all those factors end up, you know, leading to not doing as much exercise, sort of changing in your lifestyle, trying to deal with the beginnings of the illness, but then the effects, the long-term effects, and end up sort of impinging your ability to enjoy exercise and enjoy things. So it kind of then snowballs into your mental health of feeling, you know, sometimes more depressed or down after having had it, and the medical profession sometimes didn't have a lot to offer. So I wonder, moving forward with new research and new things, what you have to say about that.
Yeah. Thanks, Heather. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. And I like that you used past tense instead of the medical community used to not recognize that. But I think, first of all, you know, one of the early clues of Lyme disease, or most common first clues, is joint pain, is migrating arthralgias, so often knee pain, but maybe then it's knee pain on one side and it jumps over, that knee doesn't hurt, the other knee hurts, or back pain and neck pain. So these are patients that I do see that we're finding out, why did they not progress in physical therapy? Or they had an x-ray and everything looks normal, but the patient clearly has pain, so we dig deeper to find out why. And my idea is that the Lyme disease, the body is fighting an infection. It's depleting energy resources away from healing from even everyday activities, just walking, you know, walking around, doing your normal day. that that's too much energy depleted relative to also fighting this battle, if you will, against Lyme disease. And chronic Lyme, I think, was a controversial concept that now the medical community admits that there is such a thing as chronic Lyme. I don't think that it's necessarily everybody's problem, but it's something we should test as part of that digging deeper to why someone did not recover quickly. And then we know that it causes neuroinflammation. There are medications that we use to decrease the inflammation associated with the pain that's causing this. But of course, we get the full treatment of antibiotics for, and a full treatment is the key phrase, for Lyme disease.
Yeah. It sounds like we've come a long way in treatment of Lyme, haven't we? We have a caller who she didn't specify, just wanted to know about arthritis in the hip. So I'm not sure specifically what they wanted to know, but is that a common spot that we see arthritis beginning?
Yes. So hip is very common. And hip, you know, sometimes we're talking about the gluteal region or, you know, buttock region, and we would differentiate if that is indeed the hip. So usually my first question I say to a patient, where is your hip? So if you point to the groin area, that typically is the hip joint itself, and there could be inflammation in the hip joint or arthritis in the hip joint in the groin. If it's the side of the hip, that's where hip bursitis is. But when it's in the gluteal region or in the back, that's very often, it could be the hip joint itself, but it very often is related to the back and the lumbar spine affecting things. So we would screen that, and we would check all of these areas. And sometimes they're two at the same time. In fact, that's extremely common, that if a person has back problems, it could affect the L5 and S1 nerves that are the key nerve supply to the hip joint itself. And over time, those muscles being weak mean that the hip joint has some extra movement, and it starts to wear down the joint, and then a person has hip arthritis and say, oh, I thought I had a back problem. Now the doctor tells me I have a hip problem, but they could have both problems, and they're very, very much interrelated.
Mm. How important is spine health as we age, and how do we protect and maintain a healthy spine?
Right. So the most important thing is to stay physically active. The spine has, the discs of the spine are seemingly the weak link in the chain, and they have notoriously poor blood supply. In fact, practically no blood supply. They get most of the nutrition into the disc and the waste material removed from the disc from just diffusing into the bones next to them or from the pulsatile action of walking and running or jumping up and down on a trampoline, but activity that puts an axial load or compression through the disc is how we keep healthy discs. It's a little bit counterintuitive to again, like people will tell them a story and say, well, I used to run, that's why I have a bad back. It's like, probably running was good for your back and helping get good nutrition in and out of your discs. But as far as that's the number one thing we can do to prevent it is to stay active, stay healthy, then good nutrition. Smoking and diabetes will definitely not help disc health and spine health. So if those are issues like diabetes, we screen very thoroughly for even pre-diabetes because it will affect spine health. And there are medications we put patients on, or of course we can do diet modifications. But in combination with building muscle and having muscle, even muscle, say in the chest and back, upper back and shoulders, is still metabolically active that will help spine health. So it doesn't have to be doing planks on the floor for spine health. Even, leg exercises, doing knee extensions are going to be metabolically active muscles that will keep the rest of the body healthy, increase testosterone levels, increase growth hormone levels, and utilize glucose so that the people are at less risk of developing diabetes.
Let me go to another question about arthritis. Arthritis can be, as we know, very painful for a lot of people, depending on where your arthritis is. Are there exercises that you can do that can ease the pain in arthritis? I know there's a lot of medications for arthritis, but what about exercise?
Yeah, I would say I don't, in the office, I do not have a sheet of exercises that I give out to patients because I think that there are professionals that are train their entire career to do that. So I will refer, and as in the Spalding Rehab Network, we have, like I said, the best therapists in the country, and they're right here on the Cape too. And so I would kind of defer, because one exercise for one patient may aggravate the next patient.
Right.
So it should be.
So it depends on where your arthritis is and what your health is.
Exactly.
Is what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it definitely should be personalized. And I even expand that to, you know, trainers and personal trainers. Mm-hmm. The entire industry of in a field of people that study this and know that. Most patients, people hire a trainer because they want to lose weight is maybe the number one, but number two would be joint pain and back pain. So there are experts who advise that, and I work in concert with them. And if they have questions, then the therapist or trainers contact me, and I communicate back to them. And
What's a zombie cell?
Okay, well, that was, as far as aging, there are multiple theories of aging. You know, we've all heard about antioxidants and that antioxidants are supposed to be good for your health, like vitamin C or blueberries. But there are different theories. So the oxidation theory is one. And one of the theories of aging is that we develop these senescent cells. They're cells that aren't quite dead, but they're not quite alive either. So they're somehow stuck in this zombie state of in-between. So some of the interventions in an anti-aging world, and we can apply this to degenerative changes in orthopedic world as far as arthritis and spine degeneration, to try to use medications that target these. They're called senolytics, and they try to remove the zombie cells or kind of wake a cell back up into its normal state. So cells go through normal, like we did biology in high school, and a cell goes from a single cell to then it pairs up and doubles everything, and then it splits off into two different cells. But if it gets stuck in that cycle, and that seems to be very pro-inflammatory and causes a cell, whether we're talking about a skin cell or we're talking about a disc in the spine, it causes that to get those characteristic changes of an older tissue. So there are medications that try to target these zombie or senescent cells.
We are talking about looking at integrated approaches to identify and treat the root cause of pain. With us is Dr. Daniel Sheehan from Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's our Healthy Lifestyles program. We're focusing on finding relief from pain. With us is Dr. Daniel Sheehan from Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Margaret is giving us a call from Mashpee. Hi, Margaret.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, Margaret.
My question is this. Is there anything that can be done for arthritis in the hip socket? When I take a walk, it hurts. Every time I flex my hip, it bothers my hip flexors.
Yes. So we would start with doing testing and find out why your hip is exactly hurting, if it was collecting fluid in your hip joint or if the joint itself is worn down. So that could start off with x-rays and MRIs. But as far as treatments, I'll paint a broad stroke. Of course, I'm not diagnosing or treating you. But I'm saying in general, we have physical therapy that would be exercises. You know, after we do testing and find out the issues, we do physical therapists. We would, from my perspective, things that I offer, there are medications to decrease inflammation. There are injections, so I do from, everybody's heard of cortisone injections, but we do ones that are not cortisone. They're called regenerative injections. And then if someone has severe arthritis and other treatments are not working, there are hip surgeries. And I don't do the surgeries, but I think there's definitely a time and a place for a surgery.
Yeah, Margaret, might be a good idea to check with your doctor about that. They might be able to help you figure that out. Dr. Sheehan, you talked about regenerative medicine techniques. Tell us what that is and you know, what that entails.
Right. That's utilizing the body's own ability to heal itself. And we have techniques, you know, from, say, dry needling would be an example of something that physical therapists do that they take a needle and try to stimulate the area to almost irritate it and cause some increased inflammation. But that inflammation is not always bad if it's controlled and in the right place anatomically and the right situation. But on other areas that I do that would be, say, prolotherapy, or how I learned even of the whole term of prolotherapy was from doing platelet-rich plasma, or we take bone marrow and we can use those agents and inject them into key spots in, say, in the spine or in a joint or around it is what maybe is part of the key, is into the supporting structures of a joint and of the spine to stimulate it to heal and get stronger. But we can use plasma is basically a patient's own blood, and we spin it in a centrifuge and separate red blood cells from the plasma, the yellow straw-colored material, and use a key part of that to inject it. And it seems to help the area get stronger. In the beginning, it increases inflammation, but ultimately that area is healthier, and in the end, it becomes less inflamed.
Yeah, sounds like we have a lot more options than we used to, for sure. You mentioned chronic inflammation, and talk about the role of chronic inflammation in aging. It's gotten a lot of public attention. What are some of the causes of chronic inflammation, and is pain typically associated with inflammation?
Yeah, well, sometimes we don't feel a chronic inflammation. It's in the background, and it's causing depleting of resources away from tissue healing. But causes of that, I think we've touched on some of them. Maybe even, you know, exercise itself is decreasing chronic inflammation. So lack of exercise may be a quote-unquote cause of increased inflammation. Maybe our bodies were just designed to be physically active, and we have a very sedentary lifestyle, especially through COVID and Zoom meetings, and you know, and technology has made us less active, and that could be in and of itself one cause. We also mentioned earlier with a phone call about chronic infections could be an underlying source of chronic inflammation. But other reasons would be diabetes itself is inflammatory. Having too many fat cells. Adipocytes are pro-inflammatory. To counter that, muscle cells tend to be anti-inflammatory. They have chemicals called myokines, which decrease inflammation. We mentioned smoking. A high carbohydrate diet would be pro-inflammatory as well. So these are, you know, kind of circles back to what we were talking before about lifestyle interventions can decrease chronic inflammation.
Yeah. Let's talk about opioids for a second. Obviously, we've got a huge problem in this country that we're starting to get a handle on, but are opioids still commonly used in the treatment of pain, or are doctors trying other approaches?
Yeah, doctors are definitely trying different approaches, and I think they were always somewhat aware. But the opioid crisis, what I see, I guess, from my perspective, very radical change as far as patient attitude and family attitude is patients are not coming in asking to, you know, have something to cover up their pain anymore. But I think that was what it's been an awareness that has changed. And I can convince a patient in a, you know, 20, 30 minute visit that, you know, being on opiates is not a good idea. But if they go home and it gets reinforced everybody else they meet and say, oh, you shouldn't have pain, you need to take a pain pill to make that go away. Instead of asking the more important question of why do you have pain and what can we do to heal that area so that the pain is gone. And now patients believe that and go home and hear that same message, so it gets reinforced throughout the whole community. So more commonly I hear people come in and say, I want to get off of these pain meds. What else can I do? And that's where adjuvant medicines or would be medicines that can be used in place of opiates and I think even using those is a little bit of a substitute toward kind of the question and the ultimate treatment, which would be why is this pain here and what can we do?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, we always talk about, you know, it's easy, you know, where's a pill to help whatever, you know, your issue is, like, you know, can I have a pill just to take care of that rather than doing all the work that it might take?
Exactly.
Do you see that people are getting away from that? I need a pill to help this, and saying, are willing to put in the work, whatever the work is, to resolve their issue?
Yeah, exactly. Yes and no. You articulate that better than I did. Yeah, in some ways, yes. You know, people understand that maybe opiates aren't the quick fix, but I think substituting this quick fix mentality has not completely changed in our society, has not changed that much. Because, again, if you know, if someone exercises an hour a day, every day, and they say that's not going to fit in their life. So it becomes a priority issue. And how do we really prioritize our health? And even some of that comes toward investing in our health. And that's not just dollars, but that could be, you know, saying, well, okay, what if you take $1,000 and invest it in your health rather than just look at what does my insurance cover? But investment is also the time and maybe even more importantly, the emotional commitment to it. And, you know, one area that I'll try to you know, talk to a patient or for coaching a patient and be like, you know, try to come up with some life goals or come up with some really outlandish big goal, like doing something that they say, I would never do that. I'm not that kind of person. I would never run a marathon. I would never do a big bike ride. I would never, you know, plan that, but they should plan it because it gives them a North Star. It gives them a goal to then train toward that. And they, it can be life-changing. Secondarily, the pain that they came in for is no longer an issue, and they have a whole other set of priorities and even a, you know, a social network around that that becomes their priority.
And they might surprise themselves and actually run that marathon or do that bike ride, right?
Exactly. And I've had patients who, even if they fail, quote unquote, they reflect back on it so positively and say, but it helped them to make those changes.
So they haven't failed. They've succeeded, right? Because they've accomplished something. They just haven't reached that big, giant goal. Let's talk to Matt.
Try again.
Let's talk to Matt, who's calling from Mashpee. Hi, Matt.
Hello. It seems almost like it's coincidence. This is Dr. Sheehan. That's my part of my family name. I just want to talk. I have a very difficult situation. I got hit by a truck in 2019 and broke my tibia and also broke my humerus bone. And when the doctors came to tell me what was wrong with my body after I got hit by the truck, the first thing they told me was, you have 5 degenerative discs in your back. Your entire lumbar spine is degenerative. And they felt that was more important to tell me than about my injuries I sustained from being hit by a truck. And now my leg does not bend. It has about 45% out of the 125% range of motion. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to always find relief on a regular basis. I was hoping to hear some possible suggestions because I'm basically getting doctors looking at me and shaking their heads.
Okay, Matt, well, thank you for the phone. I'm sorry about your accident. Now, Dr. Sheehan can't, you know, give you your personal, you know, diagnosis and suggestion here, but maybe generally, Dr. Sheehan, do you have any thoughts that Matt could take into consideration generally?
Right. Well, I think he made a great point about how this term degenerative disc disease is such a looming, horrible term that, you know, in his case, it overshadowed his severe acute injuries that but it's, I think it's poorly understood. And on the one hand, you know, medical students will be told that this is normal, that these are normal findings. It's not really a disease. On the other hand, it can be devastating for someone to be told that they have something degenerating, you know, deep in their core. And that's, and what can we do about that? And but I do think that there are these newer treatments that we are not taking this as a diagnosis that you are helpless and there's nothing you can do about it. That degenerative discs lose some of their fluid. They look darker. There's a term called dark disc disease that the discs look darker than a disc that has a lot of fluid in it. But if it's something manageable, now these diseases of aging are something that we can try to treat. And if we utilize treatment interventions, we can not necessarily change the color of the disc on an MRI, but we sure can change the symptoms that people experience. Because if the discs do lose some of their disc height, then that will put more pressure on facet joints or cause stenosis, and it becomes a spiral of problems, but I would look at it more as an opportunity to say, well, what can I do to make changes so that these discs don't degenerate anymore, and they're not symptomatic.
Talk a little about the role of depression and melancholy rehabilitation. It can be, I'm thinking of poor Matt, with all the things going on, there's got to be some times where he's feeling pretty depressed about that, and that's pretty common, right?
Yeah, and pain and depression are an integrated feedback loop on each other. It starts with education and saying, let's identify what are the issues and kind of figuring out the diagnosis itself and see if it's something that's a situational depression because it's just a misunderstanding, or I don't mean just as a dismissing, I mean as something that we could kind of clarify the issues and have an understanding and kind of an action plan. On the other hand, chronic depression, it seems to be in neuroinflammatory process, that as there is the same processes that we talk about inflammation in a joint can happen in the microglia of the brain, and it can be a chronic problem that if there are we address that, not just with antidepressants like increasing serotonin levels, because that doesn't change the underlying inflammation. And if a patient is depressed, of course, they're going to feel more pain. If they have more pain and they're not seeing any hope, they're going to be more depressed. So it becomes this feedback loop. But luckily, some of the treatment interventions can work for both.
So what are some of the components then of a holistic treatment plan? You know, so some patients may not be helped by just traditional approaches. So talk about this holistic treatment plan.
Yeah, and I tread carefully on the word. Sometimes when you ask about how doctors define themselves as a physiatrist or a rehab medicine, I don't necessarily say that my approach is more holistic than another doctor, because I have respect for family physicians. Very, very holistic. They're treating every component of a person, and other specialties as well, like psychiatry or internal medicine. Of course, they're also looking holistically. But I think the way I say it is a larger toolbox. And all of us as doctors, if we don't have answers, we can now, thanks to the internet, we can now crowdsource with our patients and say, well, do you have ideas? And that's part of that holistic, and say, well, ask your friends and ask your family, and here's a term, and I'll write it down and say, read about this and call me back if you have questions. That's one way to broaden or deepen the toolbox of options that we have for treatment. But I wouldn't dismiss something and say, because I don't know about it. So, probably every day a patient could ask me about a different supplement, and I'm like, I just don't know. I mean, nobody can know every supplement on the market and what they do. But I wouldn't dismiss it out of hand and say, well, therefore it doesn't work, because I don't know. So I think that's holistic. I'll try different approaches, sure.
It kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier about striving to empower your patients and collaborate with them, right? So it's really, in a way, it's a team, right?
Absolutely, and I'm only probably a minor player on the team, and hopefully a temporary player on the team, because the patient will then be informed and have resources and ask questions and maybe circle back later with a different question.
Mm-hmm. So we have just about a minute left. Final thoughts on this that you'd like listeners to keep in mind?
Ideally to realize that the body is always trying to heal itself, that it has amazing capacity. I think we are at a time in history right now with medicines that there are many, many medications that are FDA approved that could be repurposed and used. Mm-hmm. And there's great research going on that the things that we thought were just normal aging and no hope for treatment.
And now there's hope, yeah.
Hope, yeah.
Dr. Daniel Sheehan at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. We'll post a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.